everybody, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. We're continuing with our series, A Catholic Response to Mormonism and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And today we're going to look into Mormonism. And what we're going to do today is just kind of give you a brief rundown of their history, very, very briefly. We're going to get into more specifics later, especially with regards to the life of Joseph Smith, who founded the Mormons. We're going to get into their chief doctrine today. If there is one of their teachings that you can't forget, and one of their teachings without which their religion cannot survive, it's this one. So let me give you a little brief introduction to the Mormon religion. Now, the official name of the Mormons is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they're often just called the LDS Church, abbreviated. And they were founded by Joseph Smith, as I mentioned, who lived from 1805 to 1844. Now, he claimed to receive revelations in the year 1820 from two individuals coming from heaven, one of which was the angel Moroni. We're going to get into that a little bit later. He was told that every Christian church that was on the face of the earth at the moment was completely corrupt, and that his job was to restore the one true religion that was established by Jesus Christ, but became completely apostate by the time of the death of the last apostle. And this is what's known as the Great Apostasy. This is their key teaching without which they cannot survive. So again, we'll deal with that a little bit more later. And what Joseph Smith did to fulfill this alleged mission is that he claimed that God had basically instituted him as a prophet, and he was someone who could allegedly communicate divine revelation, and in fact was inspired to write more scripture. There are three books that Mormons claim are sacred scripture, aside from the Bible: the Book of Mormon, which no doubt you've heard of, another book called Doctrines and Covenants, and one more called The Pearl of Great Price. And they also believe, by the way, that after Joseph Smith, every successive leader of the Mormons, every president of the Latter-day Saints, is also an inspired prophet on earth. Now, in his excellent series, Beginning Apologetics, Jim Burnham, who's a great friend of the program, great friend of Relevant Radio, has really laid out a good case for how to talk to Mormons. I'm going to summarize a lot of what Jim is saying here on this program. But just like the Jehovah's Witnesses, there's some common sources from which the Mormons spring. Number one, Protestantism. Joseph Smith, before founding Mormonism, was a Protestant, very similar to Charles Taze Russell, who founded the Jehovah's Witnesses. We talked about him when we covered their religion. And just like Charles Taze Russell, he carried over a lot of Protestant errors into his new faith: a denial of the sacraments, a denial of the Catholic Church as being instituted by Christ, a rejection of Marian teachings, and also rejecting the books of the Old Testament that are known as the Apocrypha by Protestants. We consider them to be sacred scripture. There are seven books in the Old Testament that are also called the Deuterocanonical books, which means second canon. The books of the Maccabees are included in those. So again, a lot of their sort of underpinnings have to do with Protestantism and also Adventism. The Adventist movement, which was really sweeping across the United States in the 1800s, gave birth to not only the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists, but also the Mormons. Now, a big difference with the Mormons as compared to the Jehovah's Witnesses is that they're not as focused on trying to predict the end of the world, the Battle of Armageddon, all that sort of stuff. And we've seen in the past the many, many failed prophecies of the Watchtower Society, the mouthpiece of the Jehovah's Witnesses. But Joseph Smith did, in fact, claim some things about the end of the world. He, in fact, said that he would be present when Jesus returned to earth, and he did predict that the world would end in the year 1890, but it hasn't been as big of a focus with the Mormons as it has been with the JWs. There's another source of influence with the Mormons that is not common with the JWs, though, and that is the influence of the Masonic Lodge. That's right, Freemasons. Joseph Smith was actually a member of the Masons. In 1842, he entered the Masonic Lodge. And a lot of the things that go on in Mormon temples, a lot of the secret ceremonies that take place there, were in fact outright stolen from the Masons. And a lot of Masons were pretty upset about this when they found out about it. And we'll get into what happened later on in this series. There's also one more source that is peculiar to the Mormons that figures heavily in the Book of Mormon. As Jim Burnham explains, colonial ministers Cotton Mather, William Penn, and Roger Williams, each one of these guys speculated during colonial times that American Indians, that North American Native peoples, were actually the lost tribes of Israel. And how that came to be is an interesting story. It's in the Book of Mormon. We will get into that later on. But Joseph Smith borrowed heavily from these guys when he taught that Palestinian Jews migrated to the Americas on Kon-Tiki rafts and set up these great civilizations that are described in the Book of Mormon. By the way, all of this took place centuries before Christ. Just keep that in mind. He, in fact, taught that these Jews came to the New World about the year 600 BC. And the two great nations that they allegedly established are the Nephites and the Lamanites. Now, there is zero archaeological evidence for any of these peoples or civilizations. They simply never existed. And this has become pretty embarrassing to the LDS organization. And a lot of former Mormon missionaries have gone out and spoken in public about the lack of evidence for this. And here's what one of them said on a PBS special on Mormonism that came out a few years ago. Quote, "I spent years telling people that American Indians were really from Israel, practiced Christianity before Columbus arrived in the New World, and wrote in Egyptian. I'm embarrassed about that. I was supposedly an educated person." End of quote. That's from a former Mormon missionary speaking on PBS. And so we're going to get into problems with the Book of Mormon later on. So stay tuned for that. But the pivotal belief that you have to focus on here is the total apostasy, the complete and total apostasy that they claim happened sometime after the death of the last apostle, very, very early on. And they think that the original teachings of Jesus and the apostles were in fact Mormon teachings, and Joseph Smith had to reestablish this in the 1820s. You'll see that that's not the case, but there are two things that Jim Burnham mentions that you have to avoid talking about when you're talking with Mormons. Number one, the concept of the Bible alone, sola scriptura, which a lot of Protestants, especially fundamentalist Protestants, they really key in on this doctrine of the Bible alone. That's not something that you can talk about with Mormons because they don't hold that. They actually believe in, there are more inspired books in the Bible out there. Don't forget, they believe that the three books that were written by Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price, they put those on the level of sacred scripture. Plus, they also believe that Revelation continues on through the presidents/prophets of the LDS organization based in Salt Lake City, Utah. And by the way, speaking of Utah, it's, a peculiarly American religion, Mormonism, just like Jehovah's Witnesses. It was swept up in the Adventist movement, kind of had its origins there, that was sweeping America in the 1800s. And America figures heavily within Mormonism as well. In fact, Joseph Smith taught that the Garden of Eden actually was in Independence, Missouri. So we'll deal with that when we get there. The other thing that you can avoid when you're talking to Mormons is the concept of purgatory. Don't mention that, because they think that every scriptural reference to purgatory refers to something that they call a spirit prison. And we'll get into that later. But anything that you would say, this refers to purgatory, they'll say, that's just the spirit prison. And we'll talk about what that is later on. The only Bible version, the only Bible translation that they accept is the King James Version. And even that has a bit of a caveat attached to it. they only accept the KJV, or the King James Version, as translated by, of course, them, the LDS organization. Also in the Book of Mormon, they claim that a lot of, quote, plain and precious things, end of quote, are missing from the Bible. Now, the LDS organization has never actually produced what they would say is an official corrected edition of the Bible, a completed King James Version Bible. So very often a strategy that they employ, their missionaries, when they're presented with a verse, even in their own preferred translation, the King James Version, that contradicts their own teachings, they just say, well, that verse was mistranslated. And not all the King James Version is correctly translated, so that's why there's a difference. So the King James Version itself is by far not the most accurate Bible translation out there. But as Jim Burnham says, it's actually probably okay to use it in your conversations with them because you're kind of working from common ground, the same translation that they themselves use. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. We're talking about Mormonism, what Mormons believe, and how you can talk to them as Catholics. So again, the first thing that we have to get to, which we're going to get to today, is this concept of the great apostasy, the great and total apostasy. Without this teaching, all of their religion falls apart like a house of cards. So it's really important that we deal with that first before we get into some of the more scandalous and more famous teachings, perhaps, of the Mormons, such as their practice of polygamy, this concept of celestial marriage, this idea that there are many gods and that every Mormon male can become a god on his own planet one day. That's not something that they tell you up front the first time they knock on your door. In fact, the first time you meet Mormon missionaries, they seem like Protestant Christians in a certain sense. Their beliefs don't seem too much different from what Protestant Christians would hold. Well, the more you talk to them, the more this stuff comes out. They don't tell you up front that they think that Jesus and Lucifer are spirit brothers. All of this we'll get into, but let's talk now about the great apostasy. Well, according to the Oxford Dictionary, apostasy is a noun that means the abandonment or renunciation of a religious or political belief or principle. It also could mean defection, because it comes from a Greek word, apostasis, which means defection. So what they think is that sometime after the death of the last apostle, you know, no later than around 100 AD, there's some dispute about when the last apostle, John, died. He was the only apostle that wasn't martyred. Some think he lived to about the year 100 AD, but at any rate, Mormons allege that at some point after the death of the last apostle, the church completely defected from what Jesus had originally taught, which they think was Mormonism. They stopped professing true apostolic teachings and began to teach pagan beliefs instead. Now, to some extent, a lot of other groups teach something along these lines as well. They just kind of differ about when everything kind of fell off the rails. A lot of Protestants think that over time, the church kind of strayed from the pure gospel of Jesus Christ and the original early church, and just like barnacles attaching to the hull of a ship, all these pagan practices eventually wormed their way into the church and accumulated, and at the end of the day, the faith looks nothing like what Jesus originally intended. Well, Mormons believe something to that effect, but they think there's this complete and total corruption of what they call the truth, and only Joseph Smith brought it back in the 1800s. Well, how can you respond to this? Well, first of all, you got to go to sacred scripture. And again, you can use their own King James translation to point out some of these passages to them. And by the way, they're familiar with this too, because they know some of the responses that Catholics would give to them. All right, so let's look at Matthew chapter 7, and this, of course, comes from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken that person to a wise man who built his house upon a rock. The rain came down, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that hears these sayings of mine and does them not will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." Okay, so that's Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 27. Jesus talks about the wise man who builds his house upon a rock. And that's obviously an image talking about the person who builds their life on his teachings. And Jim Burnham says, well, hang on here. Jesus has to be at least as smart as the man in his own parable. When Jesus is building his church on a rock, is he going to build this organization to last until the end of time? Or is he going to build a shabby organization, a shabby church with poor materials, as it were, that's not going to stand the test of time? Let's fast forward to another set of verses in Matthew's gospel, in Matthew chapter 16. And this is obviously the famous account of Jesus instituting Peter as the rock on which he's going to build his church as the first pope. "Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do men say that the Son of Man is?' And they said, 'Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets.' He said to them, 'But who do you say that I am?' Simon Peter replied, 'You are the Christ, the Son of the living God.' And Jesus answered him, 'Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades, or the gates of hell, shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven.' Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ." Okay, so that's in Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 to 20. So don't forget, in the background, and this is a nice linkage that Jim Burnham provides in his Beginning Apologetics series, and I encourage everybody to go get those resources. You can find them online. Is Jesus at least as wise as the person in his parable? Of course. So when Jesus builds his church on a rock, this is an indication that it's going to be permanent. And he says, hey, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. If in some way false teachings were to infiltrate the church to the point where it became totally corrupt, there was a total apostasy, the organization that he founded stopped teaching the truth after the death of the last apostle, well, then the gates of hell did in some way prevail against the church. We know that that is not possible. We know Jesus isn't a liar. So we know that this can't be the case. Now, obviously, these verses also have a lot of import for the doctrine of the papacy. Jesus changes Simon's name to Peter, which means rock. And he did this at a rock formation at Caesarea Philippi. It was really a very living image or parable of what Jesus was doing. We've gotten into this in previous episodes of the Faith Explained in the Gospel of Mark series, so you can go back to those podcasts and check them out. But the point of the matter is the permanence of the church, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It will never cease to exist or be wiped off the face of the earth or stop teaching the truth, as Mormons allege happened with this so-called great apostasy. All right, so let's take a look at some other verses here in Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 to 18. This could be brought into play as well. When there's a dispute, you're supposed to take it to your brother, talk to him about it. If he doesn't listen to you, take one or two more so that everything can be established by two or three witnesses. That's kind of the biblical precedent. And if he doesn't listen to you and a couple friends, Jesus says, tell it to the church. Tell it to the church. But if he doesn't listen to the church, let him be like a heathen, like a pagan, like a publican. And then he says, whatever you will bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. So the point of this is that Jesus says, if you've got disputes, you're supposed to take it to the church. Well, that presupposes that there is an organization. There is a church that he establishes, and that's going to last, that people can go to. Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, at the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, "Behold, I am with you always until the very end of the age." So if Jesus is always with the church, how is it possible? How is it probable that this great apostasy could have taken place, that somehow error would creep in and lies would become the norm? Burnham also mentions what St. Paul writes in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. When the church is described as the house of God, the church of the living God, the pillar and ground, or pillar and foundation of the truth. And this again indicates the permanence of what Jesus has founded, the pillar and ground, foundation, stability. It's always going to be here until Jesus returns. Now, Mormons do cite some verses that talk about issues in the church, people abandoning the truth. For example, Matthew 7:15, Acts 20:29, 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 3, 2 Peter 2 verse 1. But this has nothing to do with a total apostasy, a total defection from the truth all around the world. There will always be individuals and little cases here and there where people abandon the truth. That's always been the way. Don't forget, Judas was one of the 12. But this idea of a total abdication of the truth is just not there in history. And nobody talks about this. There is no reference in any church history or secular history to this great apostasy. So that's why it's really important to know the writings of the early church fathers, who came about, the first generation of church fathers, after the apostles passed on their authority to them. They left a lot of writings behind, and we see that their beliefs were not Mormon beliefs, but they were Catholic beliefs. You'll never find any of the fathers of the church talking about polygamy. You'll never see any of them talking about the existence of many gods. It's just not there. But we do have evidence that the early church was Catholic. We're going to look into what the fathers say about church beliefs later on. Burnham also gives a couple of other quick arguments against this concept of the great apostasy. And remember, this is their key doctrine. Without it, their religion, the Mormon religion, falls apart. The canon of the Bible, the very number of inspired books that are in the New Testament, they're in the Bible as a whole. The Catholic Church fixed the canon approximately 400 AD at church councils. And so Mormons accept this canon. Mormons accept the inspired list of New Testament books as defined by the Catholic Church. But hang on here. This took place, this final determination of the canon took place around 400 AD. Again, this is 200 years after they say the great apostasy happened. So this is incredibly inconsistent. You say that you reject the authority of the Catholic Church, you can tell your Mormon friend, but you accept their authority concerning the Bible. How is that possible? Okay, so that's one thing that you can point out. Protestants also accept this inspired list of books as well. Again, it's a little bit inconsistent. Burnham also mentions the historical argument. Why is it that even secular historians and all the history books, church history is narrated? We know about the split that occurred between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox churches of the East in about the year 1000 AD. We know about the Arian heresy that really gave rise to the Council of Nicaea. We know about the advent of Protestantism in the 16th century. How come nobody ever talks about something called a total apostasy? No historian of the times talks about the church completely defecting from what it used to believe. Surely, as Burnham writes, someone must have noticed the church's enemies, pagan historians, or non-apostatizing Christians. At the very least, early Christians who were trying to stay faithful to the original Mormon teachings of the Apostolic Church would have raised a massive outcry as the rest of the Christian world slipped into apostasy. But history does not record even a syllable of protest. The historical silence is deafening. End of quote. And he points out that a lot of non-Christians, especially in the early days, they were very aware, at least at some level, of what the church was teaching. He gives the example of Julian the Apostate, talk about great apostasy. This guy's name was Julian the Apostate. Well, he knew that Jesus predicted that the temple was going to be destroyed. And obviously, you can find this in the Gospels in Matthew 24. That's one place. Well, the temple actually was destroyed, of course, in the year 70 AD in the Great Jewish War with the Romans. Now, Jesus didn't say anything about a temple being rebuilt, but Julian the Apostate said that he actually misconstrued the teaching of Christ. He thought Jesus was saying that the temple would never be rebuilt. So he said, I'm going to prove Jesus wrong here. He tried to rebuild the temple only to try to discredit Christianity by trying to prove that Jesus' prophecy was false. Well, Jesus never said anything about rebuilding the temple. So that was kind of a huge mistake in the first place. But the point is that even pagans understood, or at least were aware of, teachings of the church. Another example, in the martyrdom of St. Lawrence, the deacon who was burned alive on a gridiron. Remember, turn me over, I'm done on this side, that famous line that he gave? Well, the Roman prefect actually quoted Jesus' words back to him, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. He said, you know, give us the treasures of the church. So St. Lawrence said, okay, so he rounded up all the poor of Rome and said, oh, here they are, all the orphans and widows, here are the treasures of the church. I don't think the prefect thought that was funny. But at any rate, they knew of, at least at some level, Jesus' teaching. But nobody in the pagan world ever said that the Christians have totally abandoned what they used to believe at first. There is no evidence of this anywhere in history. So as Burnham says, hey, the burden of proof falls upon the prosecution. Ask your Mormon friend, ask the missionary who knocks on your door, give me some facts. When did this great apostasy happen? Who started it? Who tried to fight against it? Well, they can't do that because it never took place. There is no record of it anywhere in history, only in their own teachings. So we're going to continue on with our series on Mormonism in the next episode of The Faith Explained. I hope that you'll join us. If you missed an episode, please check the podcast and please share them with a friend. God bless you, and we'll see you in the next one. Until then, I'm Gale Clark.